Ahoy, ahoy. Welcome to Head Games, the science psychology of sports. I'm Dr. Brett Levine, joined as always by Dr. Ben Rosenberg. Our guest today is an associate professor of sports marketing at Temple University. He has published over 45 peer-reviewed articles and presented at both academic and industry conferences. He also founded the sports analytics program at Temple, which is pretty cool. And in his past life, he was lucky enough to work for the Moneyball A's in the early 2000s. Professor Joris Dreher. Dr. Dreher, welcome to Head Games.
Cool, thanks. Awesome to be here. Yeah, it's fun. Always fun to talk analytics, talk sports with people. So happy to engage.
We're happy to have you. We're going to have tons of questions about digging up skeletons and questions of your past. So no pressure at all. But let's start with Moneyball A's and really this paradigm shift that I think was going on during in baseball that you were a part of. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what your job was with the A's and sort of what was that like? What was it like during that time period?
Yeah, so the analytics department at that time was really quite small, maybe four or five of us. And it was all just very manual. And the level of sophistication back then was prehistoric compared to what they're doing today. So my job really was, you know, we do these little like side projects and things like that. I'll tell you about one about the sacrifice bunt that I did that took me basically a whole summer. But yeah, preparing scouting reports for teams, a lot of stuff pre-draft, compiling, you know, scouting reports, again, still largely based on some of the subjective scouting data that was really the focus of the Moneyball book. And they respected and appreciated those metrics, even though they weren't necessarily based in stats or analytics or player performance or anything like that. So there's still a lot of stock placed in that. I think the movie and the book maybe over dramatizes this divide between scouting and analytics. They were kind of working in harmony. There were still some old school baseball guys, and I'm sure the coaching staff was maybe even more so that was hesitant to listen to what the numbers were saying. But that divide was, I think, a little bit exaggerated. Yeah. And then, you know, there was a program that they were using, and I think they still use today, though I imagine it's much more sophisticated, called the BATS program. And with this program, you could like enter in every pitch, you know, and track really as much data as you wanted to. And then, you know, me, I could go in there and basically pull out notable matchups or situational statistics that were somehow meaningful moving forward. So I could track based on who the pitcher was, what their tendencies were in certain counts, certain matchups between pitcher and hitter that maybe the coaches would look to exploit. And actually, a big part of what I was doing at that time with a big provider of statistical data was MLB.com. And so I would just go into MLB.com and pull relevant stats and situational stats and things like that that might be relevant and present those in a report back to the coaches. So kind of all over the place. But I would say I spent most of my time just surfing the web and futzing around on Excel, really.
Scraping data from MLB.com to try to build some stuff. You mentioned a sacrifice bunt report, but are there any, either that, or is there any other one project or one finding or kind of piece of research, I guess we could call it, that really stuck with you from your time there?
Yeah. So the sac bunt one is a funny one. I tell this story all the time to my students. You know, they wanted to figure out if sac bunts were worth it. Like, was that a good decision or not to give up an out for a base? And so, you know, today I imagine these analysts could go in about 35 minutes and punch in some code and figure out what the answer is to that question. For me, this was like a 3-month project, and it involved looking at like either MLB.com or ESPN.com and tracking game logs and basically counting the number of runs they scored with no outs, nobody on, no outs, runner on first, one out, runner on second, two outs, runner on third, and counting the number of runs that they scored in each circumstance over the course of a season. And then we'd determine, again, were you more likely to score more runs with first and second one out compared to second and third two out? The answer was no, that you should never trade an out. And so the A's, I think a couple years ago, I know this was true like up until August or September, but they were one of the first teams that had no sac bunts up until that point in the season. They just sort of stopped doing it. I don't know that that's a stat they really tracked for a very long time, but I sort of felt a sense of pride or ownership over that, even though it was like 20 years later. It was like, yeah, that was me.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. I think, I don't know if it was sack bunting or something else, but like the value created from, I think bunting in general, there's like this movement against just the idea of bunting just being like an not a very good idea in terms of sacrificing an out.
The challenge is that, and again, analytics really exposes the complexities of each situation. So, you know, some of which it depends on, you know, late in the season scores, you know, in the playoffs scores are a little bit lower, whether the pitcher's hitting, who's on deck, what their batting average is, what their matchup looks like. Like, you can start to slice and dice that analysis in a much more complex way now. And I just, I don't think you can paint with as broad a brush and say sack bunts are always bad. I think, you know, you could potentially point to some of the A's playoff failures as like, well, you know, at some point you just got to score a run in the playoffs because it might be a 1-0 game. And often is.
Right. There's speed. There's speed on the base paths, there's speed at the plate. There's the pitcher, all that stuff. So, all right. So here you were with the A's. And I think obviously what was illustrated so well in the movie and the book was that they're one of these small market teams, right? And that these scrappier teams have to do things like this, like, you know, start a analytics movement to compete with the big dogs, to compete with, you know, the big market teams like Yankees, Red Sox, Dodgers. So I think what's cool still is that small market teams are still able to compete. And this last season, I think, you know, it was a weird season, but it was still cool to see the Tampa Bay Rays in the World Series against a bigger market team like the Dodgers. Question for you, I think, is at least in the short term, how do small market teams continue to compete? How do you think they're able to still show up in the World Series?
The Rays and A's are kind of the exception to the rule, right? So you've had like the Royals a few years ago, a little flash in the pan small market team that had like this crop of talent come up at the same time, won a World Series, like awesome. Pirates, small market team. I don't know if you could classify the Brewers as like a true small market. They've actually spent some money in recent years. Trying to think of others. Marlins, of course, classic example, even though they're not a small market team, a small budget team anyways. And so I think, you know, you look at those two teams in particular and you can start to identify different approaches to winning. So I think the A's are a little bit more conservative. They tend to take the lower risk, maybe lower reward type of player. You know, they focus on to this day, focus on undervalued attributes, characteristics, skill sets. You know, it used to be, on base percentage and walks and things like that. Now I think they're moving towards, they were one of the pioneers of the launch angle stuff. I think defense is one that they've really honed in the last couple of years as a true undervalued metric, and one that's also really translatable from like college, like in the draft. You can identify a premium defensive player fairly early, and that skill should sustain through their professional career, maybe more so than like the move to wooden bats, the move to like better breaking pitches. And like, you just don't know how players are going to deal with that type of transition, but you do know if they can run and they can play defense. I think they exploited the lefty-righty matchup, so they have a lot of platoons now, because that's, I think, the one situational stat that really holds up over time, you know, like where you hit in the batting order, home and away, day game, night game. None of those situational stats matter, but lefty-righty still matters, or righty-lefty still matters. So they tend to be like fairly conservative with that stuff, whereas I think the Rays are the opposite, and they take these like really risky high-end talents. And I think hat tip for the Rays goes to their player development system, because they're able to like get so much out of their players that they can take. I mean, the Chris Archer trade was such a like iconic one for them, as they took these two players in Glasnow and
Meadows.
Thank you. And essentially like just pulled all the talent out of them that the Pirates couldn't. And so, and again, those are the kinds of gambles that they have to take. And again, they've done it with some sustained success, which is amazing given the level of risk that I think they approach their player evaluations with.
It's really interesting. It's funny. We like, at least the way that I characterized it, and maybe others, is that we think all small market teams are the same. And I think the way that you have really painted this is that, you know, desperation means different things for different teams. And I'm not saying they're not desperate, but I mean, you know, like a smaller amount of resources that these teams have will cause these teams to operate differently. You said for the A's, it's just about like maybe exploiting certain things, but the Rays are different in terms of rolling the dice. I guess then the question in the long term is different depending on who we're talking about. But if that's the short term, what do small market teams like the A's or the Rays or the Pirates look like in 5 years or in 10 years? Because at a certain point, can the A's just start running out of things to exploit? And do the Rays just like, we can't gamble anymore? Like, you know, we just can't compete with the teams that, you know, can spend the money on more assured talent. Like, what does this look like in the long term?
Yeah, I mean, I think, anytime you talk about risk reward, like at some point you run out of opportunities. And again, when you don't have the resources to cover up mistakes, you know, that's, I can remember years ago, and you'd have to be a little bit older and a real baseball junkie to remember this, but I remember when Steve Carce signed a big contract with the Yankees. He signed like 4 years, $16 million, which at the time for like a middle reliever was like gobs and gobs and gobs of money. And he wasn't going to be a closer. They had Rivera there still at the time. He was purely a middle reliever and they were dropping 4 minutes and he sucked. I mean, he just didn't do anything. His skills didn't translate. I don't know if he cracked under the pressure in New York, like a lot of guys do, but they could afford to move on. Like the A's can't afford to make those mistakes. For example, they signed their one long-term deal that they've signed over the course of the last like 10, 15 years was Eric Chavez, who like didn't really pan out. And then Chris Davis recently, who they actually paid pretty good money to, also didn't pan out. And you just, if you're in that situation, those single mistakes can be totally crippling. So at some point, those teams make those kinds of mistakes and either get, you know, bad luck with injuries or players that underperform for whatever reason. I know Chavez was like a big injury guy, had major back problems and whatever else, but you just can't afford to cover up those mistakes. Or it's like the Yankees wasting $16 million on Steve Carce was like, who's Steve Carce?
Pennies. Yeah. 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 I think that's an interesting point that these small market teams have such a small margin for error, right? I mean, one miss and you're screwed potentially for the next 4, 5, 6 years. And any ability to reach in the purse strings and make another move is basically gone at that point. And the one memory I have of Eric Chavez growing up around here in that era and going to a lot of A's games in that era is him swinging and missing at high fastballs for some reason. That image will not leave my mind. All of those playoff failures, I think, is what will stick with me. And to me, I think it's just in this interesting, can these small market teams, I guess the question is, can these small market teams ever get over the hump? Right. We've seen them make these pushes. The A's win 90 games, it seems like, every year. But how does that translate to the postseason? The Rays almost did it. But how does that translate to the postseason? How do the strategies you're talking about translate to the postseason?
Yeah, I think the Rays are kind of on. I think the A's are starting to acknowledge that in the playoffs, the need for like real high end talent is there. It's real. Like I think that's what you see in the postseason in baseball is like guys that throw real, real hard, do real, real well in the postseason. You know, like these super talented players start to really like rise to the top in the postseason. And I don't think that's a mistake. And these guys who, you know, over the course of a season are going to put up a, you know, 380 on base percentage and be a nice solid contributor and not make a lot of errors. Like that probably just doesn't do a hell of a lot for you in the postseason or might not do it for you in the postseason.
Yeah.
So I think like, for example, the A's taking Kyler Murray in the draft in the first round was like a little bit of a departure from this like more conservative approach to player development. It was like looking for this high end guy. And I think they drafted him 9th or something like that in the draft and say, hey, you know what? We got to take a gamble. And we think this guy can be like a super, superstar. So he may never play for us, but we got to take the chance. And I think that was kind of an acknowledgement that like the high end talent in the postseason is really what you need to get over the hump. And I think the Rays with some of those traits that we talked about kind of exemplify that a little bit in terms of like, you know, really hitting on some draft picks with Blake Snell, who they just traded, and some others, but then also hitting on some of this high end talent through trades.
Yeah. It seems like baseball folks often are so obsessed with sample size, right? And looking at what happens over the long run of 162 game season. And that's really important, but sample size doesn't play the same role once you get into the postseason, right? One game versus 162 games or 5 or 7 game series versus 162 games, very different things. We're statisticians, we're psychologists. We know that probability tells you very different things might happen in each of those two scenarios.
Yeah, the one thing I think I've noticed over the last few years is, and I think the player salaries really reflect this, is that you have the real high-end talent and then you kind of have everybody else. So this like top 5 or 10% is really what makes, and it's like really magnified in the NBA, for example, where like 10 guys like make or break the league every year. And I think, you know, in baseball, maybe a little less magnified, but there's this cluster of players who are all very good baseball players. And some of them might still be in the minors. Some of them are in their majors. But the difference, like within a 1 week season, like, or a 1 week postseason or 2 week postseason, like you're just not going to notice those differences. I think in the book Moneyball, they talk about, like, you know, over the course of a season, the difference between a 275 hitter and a 300 hitter is like one bloop single every 2 weeks. Like, you're just not going to notice that.
That's awesome.
But that's the difference between those two guys. And you would never see it except for the star players. And there you can, like, really see the talent. You can see it manifest itself. I think we saw it with Mookie Betts in the postseason this year, like a total difference maker.
Yeah, for sure. So I want to stick with the Billy thing a little bit, but maybe switch gears slightly with the theme. So there's been a lot of rumors, as I'm sure you've heard, about Billy jumping ship, leaving the A's, joining the Fenway Sports Group, but not actually being involved with the Red Sox, supposedly running some European soccer team or whatever. So my question is, you've had some interaction with Billy. You have had a foot in the industrial world. You've also had a foot in academia. What is it about this move that might entice somebody like Billy to jump ship from being in baseball for so long?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think when the A's re-signed him a couple years ago, they gave him some equity in the organization. So I don't think they'd let him leave to go to another baseball team. So I'm sure there's like a contractual reason why he's not. But he's been really dabbling in soccer for a while now. And I know he goes out to Holland every now and again. I'm born in Holland, actually. And he works closely with one of the Eredivisie teams in Holland with Dutch football. And I don't know, the best I can think of is analysts, particularly like at the higher levels, are strategists, right? They want to understand, they want to exploit the inefficiency. That's Moneyball, right? It's exploiting inefficiencies. Soccer, they haven't really uncovered that. They haven't really solved that riddle yet, especially in terms of like how analytics can be used to solve that problem. Because like soccer analytics, and I've got a couple students working in soccer analytics now, it's tough because you don't have like a hit or a home run or whatever, or even a launch angle or a spin rate. You have a scoring chance, which is like very subjectively defined. And you have two goals a game maybe. And so like to come up with those outputs, to come up with like, what are the skill sets? What are the metrics that matter? I think is largely still evolving. And so I wonder if Billy just sees it as a clean slate like he had in the late 90s, early 2000s, where he could really think outside the box in terms of like, what's his approach to baseball? And now what's his approach to soccer. And I think maybe he likes that like clean slate, that opportunity to sort of like reinvent another sport. And again, I add to that, that I think one of Billy's strengths is his like persona. He's like larger than life. He has the ego to go with it. And so I think this idea of like reinventing a second sport, like maybe kind of appeals to him.
Yeah. Or maybe this is total conspiracy theory, but like maybe he sees the writing on the wall. Like maybe he's like, I don't know how much there is to exploit anymore. We're limited. You know, there's only a finite number of things that we can investigate, and maybe he wants to jump ship. I don't know.
I think he's, I certainly agree with that. I think he's done it with the A's. He's done it for a sustained period of time. You know, people said, oh yeah, you did it. It's once, it's nice. You hit on some nice draft picks with, you know, Hudson and Zito and a good trade for Mulder and things like, or I think, did they draft Mulder or they trade? I don't remember. But anyways, Heron is the guy they traded for. But anyways, so, you know, they hit on some things. People thought, oh, maybe he's just a flash in the pan or got lucky or whatever it was. But he's done it and he's achieved that sustained success. And I think, yeah, there are limits to what the A's can achieve with a small budget. And I've given all I can to the game. It's time to move on to something else. Like, doesn't seem to me like that outlandish a narrative at all.
Yeah. The king of the nerds moves on to near to your pastures, I guess.
Yeah. But man, there's like tons of opportunity and certainly tons of money in soccer, right? And there's huge growth overseas. There's huge growth domestically. I think to be in a leading kind of the leading wave of the analytics movement in soccer has got to be real appealing to him.
Yeah. This proliferation of analytics that I think obviously Bean is credited with a big portion of, although I don't think he was the initial person, but I guess the catalyst really, I think it's changed the game a lot. And obviously here we are, as Ben mentioned earlier, people who might have a stats background or what have you, but that's not to say that everyone, every baseball fan out there understands or comprehends any of these analytics. I'm not saying that that is the cause for the, why baseball is becoming a hell of a lot more regionalized than it used to be. it is definitely much less of a national game as compared to the NBA and the NFL. I guess there is a correlation there. I don't know if analytics are the cause of that. It could just be the appeal or a generational thing, but it's sort of kind of losing its appeal to younger generations. So my question to you is, if you were commissioner of baseball, how would you save it in terms of fandom, in terms of viewership, call it dollars, you know, what would you do to make the game, you know, more exciting again or more appealing to more fans?
I mean, I think the narrative that like the younger generation doesn't like sports is also a bit overblown. You know, I think like fandom and viewership are two very different things. And a lot of the research that we've done, we look at like consumption, and consumption takes so many different forms, right? In today's world. Whereas like, if you remember, you know, when I was growing up, I don't know exactly how old you guys are, but like, it was like, I had MSG Network, the best in the game on the East Coast, right? And it was Knicks, Rangers, Yankees. And those were my three favorite teams because they were on MSG Network. And that's how I became a fan, right? It's like, oh, I like these sports. I like watching the games. Therefore, I am a fan, you know? And I just think that like people don't consume that way anymore. Like regional TV broadcasts of sports teams like still exist, but it's much less prominent than it was given the diversity of like program options on television now. And you could just as easily be, you know, if you really like Bryce Harper and you happen to live in Colorado, you can for $10 a month watch every Bryce Harper game. And like, it doesn't matter that he's local. And so, yeah, your form of consumption may be different. Maybe you're watching games on TV, maybe not. Maybe you're just watching highlights. You're probably not going to games unless he's playing in Colorado or something like that. And so just the nature of fandom is really changing. I think the challenge is that like with television, it's really easy to monetize that, right? Like that model has been very well established with advertising and media rights and so forth. How to monetize like when somebody tweets about Bryce Harper is like much more difficult. But that's how people consume, is they like to talk about it. You know, they start conversations, they have podcasts, they just chat about it. How the Phillies or MLB monetizes Bryce Harper in those contexts is a huge challenge.
So in some ways it sounds like you're saying it's a operational issue, right? Like we're actually just defining consumption incorrectly or too narrowly, right? And so you're saying this in some of your research, you guys have defined it more broadly to include all these different things and ways of engaging with people's teams or players. What are some of the psychological aspects of that fan engagement that draw people and keep them engaged?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've been like wrestling with this theory for a long time. So in a lot of like the sport marketing research, they seem to start with the idea that like somebody is a fan of a team, right? So, you know, again, I am a 49ers fan, like period. I'm a 49ers fan. That's how I start my football consumption. And from there, everything branches off of my love of the 49ers. And like, it's actually just not true anymore. I really think it starts with a love of football, right? And as a football fanatic, I want to consume in a number of different ways. So like, I want to pick a favorite team that makes my game day experience much more fun. I get to enjoy all the social dimensions of having a favorite team and going to a bar and watching with my friends and cheering on and blah, blah, blah. But I also want to consume because I love football so much. I also want to play fantasy football because it's cool to like build my own team. And now I can like follow a bunch of different players. And even though the 49ers game isn't on, or even though they're 6-10, like, you know, I can still enjoy football Sundays. Like, that's awesome. Like, I like that experience. And I think we're even starting to move that direction with like daily fantasy was the same thing. And like these people who love football consume in any way they can. And that includes like, you know, fantasy sports, daily fantasy, moving into gambling now. It includes like Twitter activity, talking to your friends, text messaging, watching YouTube videos, watching highlight shows, watching SportsCenter, like it includes all of those things. So it's just like, it's like need of like, give me more. It's like any other industry where you have these like super consumers that exist, and the NFL and all these other sports leagues and teams just keep giving them opportunities to engage. It's again, like I said before, it's just a challenge of which one of those they can monetize.
But I think the way that you answer that question scares me as a baseball fan, because what you said is, you know, the typical model, what people assume is the typical model is like, I'm a Mets fan, and then all of my fandom comes from being a Mets fan. And what you're saying is, I am a football fan, or I am a hockey fan, and then that's how things expand from there. And that to me says like, well, then it's really about the nature of the sport to begin with that draws in, I'm going to guess, younger people, because that's when fandom begins, when we're usually when we're younger, right? So is there just something innate about the boringness or the less excitement of baseball that takes second or third or fourth place compared to sports like basketball and football?
Yeah, I mean, probably. I mean, it certainly is a slower sport. I think golf started to see that too, where it was like, you know, Tiger Woods comes along, everybody loves it, and then they realize it takes 6 hours to play a round of golf, and they're like, yeah, I don't know about it.
Yeah, I know. I think we're like rediscovering something that I think has been noted, at least in popular culture, is that, yeah, it's a slow game, you know, and people have noticed that. And I think baseball's method for that is like, well, let's speed the fucking thing up. Like, just, you know, let's go quicker, which is another discussion for another time about.
Don't get me started on
that. But yeah, I think it's discouraging. And I'm wondering what ways of saving it, like if what can be done. Like, I don't want to change the sport fundamentally, but it would be great for it to be, it doesn't have to be the biggest sport in the United States, but I think the fear is that it would disappear one day, you know?
I think we're at, you know, all the leagues take the same approach to like making the game more exciting. And the NFL has done that with, you know, trying to open up the passing game and protecting quarterbacks. The NHL, maybe going back 15 years ago with like the blue line trap that the Devils used to run, like tried to open up the game. And so let change the rules. Baseball's trying to do that. Where I worry is like when you start changing the fundamental nature of how the game is played, you know, I know like golf has talked about like, well, we should do like 12 hole tournaments or make the hole this big.
Yeah.
And then people will have more fun. And baseball, they've talked about 7-inning games, and they've talked about like, I don't know. I still find like great enjoyment in sitting and watching a game. It's a different kind of consumption than watching football, where like it's every play and I'm watching. Like I can very passively watch baseball as opposed to being a more active consumer of football. And yeah, I think now about like, if you go to like NBCSports.com and they do these like extended highlight reels, like 15-minute clips of soccer games, of Premier League games. And it's not like a 2-minute highlight reel where it's like, here's this player hitting a home run, here's this player hitting a home run, and here's the strikeout to close the game. Like, it's not those kinds of highlight packages. It's like, okay, here's the buildup for the 2 minutes before the first goal. Here's some like action that goes on here before this player gets a red card. And they like kind of just show the buildup a little bit. And so maybe it's starting to like think about how to repackage some of the bite-sized nuggets for people to consume so that they don't have to give 3 hours of their time, because they're... Yeah. The majority of sports fans aren't going to sit and watch a 3-hour game.
Yeah.
I just think reality.
You mentioned gambling, and I think we have some questions around some of your work around gambling. This is just, here's another idea. Here's, I'm going to throw another anecdote out there. I really think fantasy sports did wonders for football. Not that even football needed it, but I really think it just helped the sport. And baseball has it. It would be great. And I don't know why baseball doesn't have like a red zone that you could tailor to your own fantasy team. It'd be hard to narrate game to game necessarily, but like a very tailored version. Like if you had X players that you could sort of tailor it in the same way Red Zone does. I think there's tons of, my point is.
Yeah.
Let's do it, guys. Stuff. Let's do better right now. The point is that I think there's with technology and with consumption, I think there's plenty of options beyond maybe what we're seeing from Major League Baseball now to sort of proliferate, you know, the sport more.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, I think, you know, fantasy football is a much more user-friendly activity. Fantasy baseball is hard work. But, you know, again, as we move into gambling or daily fantasy and some of these more like faster paced types of gambling or playing types of activities. Yeah, I think you're right. Like, I don't think there's any reason why you couldn't tailor it to like you get an alert when Bryce Harper's coming up to bat. I don't know why he's front and center in my head right now, but you get an alert and then you can like quickly flip on your phone and watch that at bat. Or, oh yeah, the, you know, this game starting, your, you know, the pitcher you selected, or the, you know, if it's a game you bet on or daily fantasy or something like that. Yeah, that those are the kinds of things that I think MLB and really all the sports need to think about, because those are the ways that people are engaging in sport now. And it's not as concentrated on, hey, it's, you know, 7:30 and on MSG Network, the Knicks game's about to start. Like, it's not like that anymore. Too fragmented, way too fragmented.
Yeah. I think another thing for baseball to think about, which I'm sure they are considering, is the perception of baseball as like a staid, old, like white dudes club, which it kind of is still. And the pushback that more younger players are bringing to the game, thinking of like Tim Anderson, guys like that, that are just showing that emotion, showing that they're having fun. And I think that has always been part of the NFL, even though people call it the no fun league, you can tell guys are having fun. And same with the NBA. And I think having a bit more of that in baseball can only help the sport, right? It's going to turn off some of your kind of old traditionalist fans, but like, fuck them, right? Like they're going to be gone anyways. They need to grasp onto some of the younger folk. And maybe that's one other way in addition to some of these strategies to bring people in.
Yeah, totally. I think they've really, I think there's a lot of energy in baseball now, but the fundamental nature of the game is that like over 162 game season, you got to pace yourself. And that means, and as psychologists, you'll certainly recognize this is like pace yourself physically, but also like emotionally, psychologically, like to be that engaged for that many games with all the travel, all the burdens, all the aches and pains and all the stuff that goes along with it. Man, it's hard. It's like, it's really, really hard. And so like, to some extent, you have to mute your emotions in game 78 of the season. You just, you can't turn it on like that all day, every day. Yeah. And so I think a lot of people enjoyed the 50 game season for that reason, that like every game really mattered. It was a lot more intense. It was a sprint instead of a marathon. And like, I think people enjoyed that. Again, it was a weird, it was a weird viewership experience with the fans and all that. But I think, you know, letting, watching the players put it all out there every game was like, was pretty cool to see.
Yeah, for sure. So going back to, you mentioned gambling before. I know I'm a bit of a gambler. I don't know if I should say that or not, since we're in California and it's not legal, but I'm a bit of a gambler. I know
Brett. Say that again, Brett. Ben, what did you say again? Say that one more time. What did you say? You're a gambler?
I like to gamble on football occasionally.
He drives to Vegas every week to place his bets.
Yeah, that's I cross the state line, log on to FanDuel. So I like to gamble on football. I know Brett would admit to liking to gamble on football as well. No, he doesn't actually either. So I guess my question is, we're starting to see more states legalize sports gambling. Would you be in favor of broad nationwide legalized sports gambling? What effect do you think it might have on fandom? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, whether I support it, I don't know if that necessarily matters. I think it's an inevitability. Like, it's going to happen. And there may be a couple of states that hang on at the very, very end that don't legalize. But, you know, it's going to be legalized. You know, I think California is moving in that direction. I was in Pennsylvania. Like, they have moved in that direction. And the experience is pretty cool. I got to say, like, you always worry about problem gambling. Like, that's always the issue. Most of the websites now are putting in at least options for players to monitor their own gambling behaviors and things like that. Again, is that totally effective? No, but I don't know. If you have that much of a problem gambling, like, you're going to find a way to gamble. Like, just because FanDuel doesn't work in your state doesn't mean you're going to stop gambling. And so, I think we're moving in that direction. I think it's very consistent with what we've been talking about in terms of like the changing nature of sports fandom. It's just going to fragment it even more, but provide users additional opportunities to consume, which is great for the leagues. Like, you know, they wanted in on this early, and I think Adam Silver was really smart in saying like, we want this, but we want a piece of the action, and we want, we'll give you the data, we'll give you the things you need, we want a slice of the pie. And I think that's a big piece of it. It's like, okay, yeah, I can't monetize the tweets about the league, but I can monetize the bets that are placed. And I think that's just another vehicle of like, you know, selling the rights of the player, selling the rights of the data, finding ways to monetize these additional consumption modes, if you want to call them that. But I think that's exactly what gambling is. It's an extension of fantasy sports, really.
Yeah. I think you alluded to that it will be a boon for everyone. It will be, you know, this is a good thing for all four, you know, major sports and others as well. I'm sure Major League Soccer is excited for it too. But do you see a sport that really stands the, like which sport do you think stands the most to gain from legalized gambling? Do you think like, this is going to be great for baseball? It's going to shoot baseball stock up, or basketball, or, you know,
I mean, football is always uniquely positioned for that, just like it is for fantasy football, in terms of like, it's once a week, it's 16 weeks. It's not too difficult to place a bet. You can watch and really enjoy the game as like an augmented experience to like enjoying a Sunday watching football. I think it's really cool. I think baseball always is advantaged from their kind of ownership of the summer. They really, if you want to bet on sports and it's July, guess what? You're betting on baseball. Like, you know, that's the only thing. So I think it benefits from that and providing fans an additional opportunity to consume in the summer months when maybe, they they just need something to do, quite frankly. And, you know, basketball, hockey, football hasn't started yet, you know, all these things. It's like, okay, well, I got to bet on baseball. So I always think that baseball is uniquely positioned for those kinds of things. But yeah, I think, you know, what's interesting to me is I think about, you know, the reports from like the Vegas casinos and the sports books, they always essentially say that the sports books break even, right? That like, it's like poker rooms too. It's like, they need to have poker rooms. They need to have sports books because people come into the casinos for those things, but they don't necessarily make a lot of money off, right? They make money off those players putting a $20 bill in a slot machine on their way out, you know, or staying and buying a drink at the bar or doing whatever else they do. So I wonder like what I'd be so curious to look at the bottom line for some of these gambling providers and see what their take is. And if the odds are better online or in person versus online because of that, I'm just curious about it. I'm curious to see how that kind of plays out. As you said, everybody wins. And they should. Like it seems to be a win-win for everybody. But again, the narrative out of Vegas has always been that the sports books more or less break even.
It will be interesting to see how it affects each sport, you know, because it's just going to change stuff. Like you can make live bets in a stadium in Europe when you're watching, you know, football, European football, excuse me, game, which I think will be interesting when you're going to be at a baseball game and you're going to be able to sit there and it's like, you know, I saw Lindor limp off after that. I think I'm going to make a, you know, bet on over under the number of runs, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
I think that is something interesting to see how it will affect fandom, how it's going to affect the games. And I'm excited. I mean, it does seem like that's the way that it's going to go. And hopefully, again, that there's help for people that need it.
FanDuel, come to California. Get me off of Bovada, my like quasi-legal gambling site that I use. Shout out Bovada, by the way.
Yeah, hashtag Bovada in due time. I want to get you out of here with a game. Are you up for a little game here?
Sure.
We're going to do over-under. We'll stick with baseball since that's been our theme and that's the area of interest for a lot of your research and obviously your background. But I want to do over-under number of wins, and we'll assume 160. 62 game season. I'm going to throw some team names out there and I'm going to give you a number. And I just want, you know, over under, if you want to provide some explanation, that's fine. If you want to just say my gut says this and we can leave it at that, that's fine as well.
Sure.
You ready? All right. Yeah. Dodgers over under 95 wins.
Over. They're loaded. I mean, the Padres are better, obviously. That's unquestionable. But the Giants are still a little ways away. Diamondbacks are still not
the strong. Diamondbacks.
They're still the Diamondbacks. I think they're just loaded. So, yeah, I see them, you know, easily in the triple digits.
Nice. Okay. So you mentioned my next team is the Padres. You said the Padres are better than the Dodgers. I was going to say
better than before. I didn't mean
better than before. Okay.
Meant like better than before.
Okay. So then Padres over under 85 wins.
I still think they're probably a year away. So I might go over a little bit just because of the weakness in the division outside of the Dodgers. But I think where you'll start to see them push, you know, 95, 100 wins is in 2022. But I think next year they're a 90 win team, probably, you know, a wild card team behind the Dodgers.
You can see that. Cubs over under 75.
Under. I think they're gonna tear it down and rebuild.
Yeah.
It sounds like Contreras is gonna get dealt. Bryant seems like they've been talking about a deal for him for a long time.
Yep.
They shouldn't payroll. They didn't get a whole hell of a lot for Darvish when they dealt him. So yeah, I think it's gonna be some dark times in Chicago.
Braves over under 85 wins.
Way over. I think they're pushing triple digits. They're that's a loaded team, loaded pitching, a lot of talent coming up. Acuna's awesome.
Yeah,
I think they're a dark horse, or maybe not even a dark horse anymore, but they're among the two or three World Series favorites for me.
Mets over under 90.
Yeah, that's
Lindor. I love Lindor. Lindor's like my favorite non-Giants baseball player.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I'm always wary of these teams, you know, these like super teams, these manufactured super teams, where they're going to sign a couple free agents. They always seem to disappoint. And so, and as cursed as the Mets have been for the last number of years, like I can imagine an environment where this just goes horribly. But they do have now Lindor, Carrasco's a good pitcher, DeGrom's the best in the game. I'll go under though. I still, I'm so wary of these environments. There's a lot of holes in that team.
Chemistry, man.
I was going to say it. Yankees over under 85.
Yeah. Again, I think they'll go over, but not by a lot. I see them as a good, not great team. They're loaded with talent too, but there's something missing. There's that swag that the Yankees have had in years past. They just don't have. And I think the team really falls apart if Cole goes down. Like he really anchors that whole team. So if anything happens to him, any he misses a handful of starts with any kind of injury, you know, they go over if he makes 25, 30 starts. They're under if he doesn't.
Yep. Yep. Okay. How about the Rays over under 80 wins?
I'll go over again. There's still real good. A lot of depth and a lot of positions. I could see them taking the East again.
Oh. Astros over under 85 wins.
God, I hope under, like way, way under.
65.
Now, as an A's fan, they've been a thorn in our side for a long time. It seems like, you know, you can only lose so much talent before it starts to show in the standings. And, you know, I think they started to show some chinks in the armor this year, losing Cole. See how good Verlander is coming back. They'll lose Springer, potentially Brantley as well. It's a lot of offensive talent, a lot of pitching to lose. But, you know, yeah, I've doubted them before, but I put them at probably a 500 team. So I think your over under was 85. So I'll go slightly under.
Okay. Two more. A's over under 85.
I mean, Ben, I think you said they win 90 every year. So I'm not about to bet against them. You know, ESPN, Buster only just did like, you know, top 10 at each position. And there's an A at almost every position in the top 10 in Major League Baseball. And they've got a top 10 first baseman. They've got a top 10 third baseman. We'll see what happens in the middle infield. They've got a top 10 catcher in Murphy, who's young and emerging. They've got a lot of talent in the rotation. Bullpen, we'll see what they do and how they build that up again. They seem to piecemeal that together every year. And Laureana and Canna in the outfield, and they always seem to, again, put together some nice matchups, you know, lefty-righty platoons in right field. So, yeah, and again, I don't think that division is super strong either. So getting stronger, but no super team in that division anymore. So yeah, I'll put them at 90, 95 wins again.
Sure. Okay. Last one, White Sox over under 75 wins.
Over again, I would put them in the same bucket as the Braves as like, you know, the team of the next 5 years. Braves, Padres, White Sox, like look out. They're three real, they're built so nicely from within, and they're starting to augment it with some free agent signings and things like that. So I like the White Sox a lot.
Even with Tony La Russa leading the ship over there, huh?
Yeah.
That's rough, dude.
I don't know the analytics on manager and manager personalities. Yeah, that's something you guys can dive into in a future.
That's good research there. I love it. Like, that's the perfect summary for Tony La Russa.
Just rough. All around rough.
But it's so interesting how these guys just get opportunity after opportunity after opportunity.
He's old white dude. He's an old, well-respected Hall of Fame white dude. Like, of course he gets opportunities, man.
Yeah.
True.
Not good.
Dr. Dreher, this was a lot of fun, man. Thanks so much for your time. This was great.
Yeah, anytime. Let's do it again. This was cool.
There's an at Joris Dreher. I'm guessing that's you.
Yeah. I'm not on Twitter too much anymore. That sounds right.
Okay. Yeah, it's you in a soccer jersey. I think you look good.
Yeah, look young. That's how inactive I've been on that one. You're right. That's at Bernabeu in Madrid.
There you go. There you go. European football roots. You and Billy Bean, you're heading over next as well. Please rate and subscribe where applicable. And thanks as always to our editing team for putting together today's show. You can find us on Twitter at HeadGamePsych. You can find me on Twitter at Dr. Brett Levine. And you can find that guy on Twitter at BD Rosenberg PhD. And thanks as always for tuning in. Bye.